Motherhood has been used to oppress and exploit women for centuries. But it doesn't have to be this way, and as mothers, we're ready for a revolution. Welcome to Rebel Mothers, the podcast that challenges the patriarchal institution of motherhood and instead reclaims mothering as an act of liberation. It's time to openly discuss how motherhood has been used to uphold systems of patriarchy, racism, and capitalism so that we can develop strategies for dismantling these institutions. We love our kids, but being a mother in a world that does not support us is disheartening and exhausting. Mothers know how important their work is, and it's time the rest of society sees the enormous potential mothering has for creating transformative social justice. I'm your host, Susie Fishleader, and together we'll embrace the revolutionary power of mothering to create a more equitable and inclusive future for ourselves and our children. Hello. So today I am bringing you a replay of a workshop that I hosted earlier this year called The Motherhood Revolution. This is normally a 2-hour long workshop that I'm able to host in person or virtually at, you know, moms groups or book clubs or organizations, schools. And what you'll hear today is the beginning half hour or so of the workshop where I establish the difference between mothering and motherhood, and then I discuss some of the cultural systems that shape motherhood, and then explain the difference between dominator and partnership family systems, along with some other stuff. So the theme of this revolution really goes along with everything I've been saying in this podcast. And then what happens after this presentation that I will play for you shortly is I help participants craft their own personal revolutionary mothering manifesto, where we examine core beliefs and values in mothering, we identify the social problems that we want to solve, and then we outline our motherhood choices and explain why these choices are the best for you and your family so that you can commit to creating the revolution from home. So after you've listened to this workshop replay, if this is something that you're interested in booking, please reach out to me by emailing me Susie@susiefishleader.com, and I hope you enjoy. So like I said, over the agenda, we're going to start with some clarification of a few terms, mothering versus motherhood, because I mean very specific things when I say those two words, and I want to make sure we're all on the same page. And defining these words was really validating in my own experience, so I want to share that with you. Then we're going to cover some forces that shape motherhood. There's innumerable forces, both personal and cultural, but I picked four of the big ones for us to talk about today. After that, we'll have an open discussion. You know, we can have a break in there if we need to. Then we'll go through our values and we'll get started on the manifesto. And then we'll wrap it up by talking about maybe what comes next. All right, mothering versus motherhood. So I want to clarify the difference between these two words. And these concepts are inspired by the work of Adrienne Rich and Andrea O'Reilly. So you can think of mothering as a verb. It's all the stuff we do, right? It's the emotional labor, the stories, the band-aids, the care, the love, everything that we do as an experience for our children. And it is an incredibly profound and meaningful experience. We compare that to the institution or the structure of motherhood as like a noun. And we can think of that as a social institution that exploits women to provide unpaid care and housework. And it can be a manipulative and unfair system that results in equality. These are pretty big statements, right? So one thing, a theme that's going to run throughout my presentation today is there are people who spend their entire careers researching and writing and talking about all of this. We're high level. Yep. So as we talk about it today, we're just going to give kind of an overview. But what I find it helpful to separate the experience of mothering and the institution of motherhood is because it gives us clearer language to use about our experiences. I can love mothering and hate motherhood, right? And I can enjoy the experience of raising my children and passing on my values and seeing it as activism and seeing it as a path of enlightenment. And I can also see that the structure of motherhood that expects me to provide free childcare and housework and all that stuff is oppressive. And I can do both of these things at the same time. Desiree and I were having a conversation last night about the both and. This is the space in which we live. Yeah. So once we can name these things, then we can start to rebel a little bit and push back and start to create the change to make motherhood not an oppressive, not a manipulative system. That's the goal. That's the revolution. Whoops. So what is the motherhood revolution? Well, it is all of us. individually and collectively, working together to create the change needed to turn motherhood from that oppressive institution into something that's easy and fun and like what being a mother is supposed to mean. One of the things that started me on this path, I went to like a mom's group kind of thing. I just moved to Indiana. I needed some friends. And I went to this group and they had a speaker talking about postpartum depression. And I would say 9 out of 10 moms raised their hands. And I was just like, what the hell is going on? How did the human species survive if 90% of our mothers have experienced some sort of like baby blues or postpartum symptoms? It's not supposed to be this way. And this was a few years ago. And it was like, so then I had to dive into all this. So here we are, right? So now we're going to start by naming the systems that shape motherhood. By naming these systems, it helps to validate our own personal experiences. It's the opposite of gaslighting. It's saying, yes, what you are experiencing is real. Like, I see it. And that can be really reassuring to realize that we're not alone, right? And that many people are experiencing this. But then the next step is once we name the systems, we need to identify ways that we can change them. And that's the work. That's what we're doing here today. We're getting started on the work. And this is lifelong work. This isn't like you get to walk away from this afternoon and be like, oh, the revolution is done. We've got it. Check. No, you will be doing this stuff for the rest of your life, right? But this will just get you started. So the forces that I'm going to talk about that shape motherhood, and you can say force, system, institution, structure, however you want to call it. But these are basically, they're the personal and cultural systems that affect us as individual mothers, as a person in my life. And then also motherhood as the institution in policy and in public. So again, none of these, oh, I want to make sure to say this too. None of these systems operate independently. So when we're working on the revolution, we're working on addressing all of them. We can't take down capitalism without addressing whiteness. We can't talk about patriarchal motherhood without talking about religion. So in the time that we have together today, we're going to learn a little bit about all of them, but we will see how they are all interconnected and work together to take them all down. So here's some very basic definitions, and then we're going to dive into each one of them. So patriarchal motherhood, this refers to motherhood under patriarchy, which is simply, it's a social system that privileges and prioritizes men and their experiences over women. Just like patriarchy prioritizes men over women, whiteness is a system that privileges lighter skin over darker skin. And understanding whiteness means understanding the history of racism and white body supremacy that's in our country. Capitalism, an economic system based on the private ownership of the means of production and the private operation of those for profits. And then religion. Now, this is tricky because there actually isn't an agreed upon definition of what counts as a religion. But in general, when we're talking about religion, we're saying it's usually a cultural system of, you know, behaviors, beliefs, morals, rituals, texts, worldviews that are defined and generally relate humanity to the supernatural. And then I put what else, because I'd love to hear, like, are there other things that you guys can think of off the top of your head that have shaped your experience as a mother or like might shape motherhood? And it's okay if you can't. Colonization, if that goes into patriarchal, it goes into whiteness, goes into capitalism and religion, all of it. Colonization is, you could kind of take it all back to that, right? But colonization is a new thing, and that's not, I'm sorry, it's not a new thing. What I mean to say is the understanding of what it means to decolonize is not as readily, like when I talk about decolonizing motherhood, people are like, huh? But when I talk about whiteness or religion, people are like, okay, yeah, I see that. So yeah, colonization for sure. All right, so let's just go in. Patriarchal motherhood. So it's patriarchy, but because we're talking about motherhood, it is motherhood under patriarchy. So it is, again, the system that prioritizes men and their experiences over women and children and our experiences as a mother. This quote is really impactful. For most of recorded history, parental violence against children and men's violence against wives was explicitly or implicitly condoned. Those who had the power to prevent and or punish this violence through religion, law, or custom openly or tacitly approved it. That's tough stuff. We're facing thousands of years of patriarchal culture, and sometimes that can get really overwhelming. There's a lot of unlearning to be done. And, you know, I'm also raising two boys who will grow up to be white men who will benefit from the system. So how do we unlearn this? Where do we go? Let's go a little bit into what it means, how it's shaped it. The first thing is the idea of the nuclear family, right? So when we think of the patriarchal family unit, this is what comes to mind, like a father at the head of the household, and you've got a mom and a dad and 2.3 kids and a goldfish. And this is like a made for TV version of the family, but it neglects to represent the majority of American households. So when we think of the nuclear family, I'm going to give you guys a lot of rhetorical questions. So just kind of keep in the back of your head, how does holding this idea up as like the pinnacle of what a family should be affect everyone else, right? How does it like create that institution of motherhood that can limit us and not empower us? So I want to talk about, okay, we don't want patriarchy. Should we just have matriarchy? Real quick, patriarchal family, men make the decisions for the family, typically extends into larger culture. Matriarchy, cultures where women have more authority. Typically, most cultures have been patriarchal, even in cultures that have been matrilineal, where the the property descends to the mother, still are patriarchal cultures. So even if we were tomorrow flipping, and now women are in charge of everything, women are the head of the household, women are president, women are all things, it's still a culture of domination. So if we flip it, it's still a structure where some people win and some people lose. And since all of our oppressions are linked, we're trying to do away with that idea. So I want to introduce the concept of, it's done by Rhianne Eisler from her book, Chalice and the Blade, a dominator culture versus a partnership culture, right? This ideology doesn't prioritize any one gender over another. It is simply a way of relating to each other in either domination or partnership. It's nice, right? I've got a lot of definitions over the next few slides. I'm not going to read all of them. So domination versus partnership, right? A domination culture is authoritarian, ranking, hierarchies, et cetera. Versus partnership, it's a hierarchy of actualization and empowerment rather than disempowerment. Fear and violence versus not fear and violence because they don't need to maintain them. Domination has these rigid binary gender stereotypes, masculine, feminine, that kind of thing. Partnership, fluid, non-binary gender roles. Difference is not equated with superiority or inferiority. Partnership parenting. So this, Rhianne Eisler started the Center for Partnership Systems, and it is a wealth of information, this website. And they actually created a connected and caring parenting guide that really dives into what parenting, like partnership parenting would look like. And how it, they don't explicitly name how it challenges patriarchal motherhood, but it does. How do we co-create the family dynamic that we desire? And again, this is one of these rhetorical questions that I want you to keep in mind as we start to work on our manifestos. When we think of challenging patriarchal motherhood in our either individual families or as a system overall, what are the things that work and what are the things that don't? Whiteness. Let's just go right in there, huh? The plague of racism is insidious, and it enters into the mind as smoothly and quietly and invisibly as floating airborne microbes enter into the bodies to find lifelong purchase in bloodstreams. Now, I happen to know most of you, and I know that most of you are familiar with these concepts, right? I wasn't sure who's going to show up, and am I going to, like, do I need to explain what white body supremacy is and what racism is? And the crowd that showed up here today, I don't think I need to spend a lot of time explaining it. So just to make sure that we're all on the same page, the ideology of whiteness is that white people, their customs, culture, and the beliefs is the standard by which all other groups are compared, right? So this results in systematic racism that is embedded in the laws and regulations of our entire society. This brings us to, there is not one universal experience of motherhood. When I'm talking about motherhood as an institution, and when I'm talking about motherhood as a social structure, let's face it, mothers in this country do not all have the same experience of mothering. I have never been afraid to let my teenage son walk downtown. You know, my children have never been targeted because of the color of their skin or the texture of their hair. I've never had to defend my family against prejudice of any kind. And a lot of that is because I'm white, because of the privileges that I hold. So acknowledging that in our own lives is important, you know, and there's a lot of great work out there, right? There's the Unpacking the Knapsack, Privilege Knapsack, Peggy McIntosh. There's a lot of work that's already out there that you can do to recognize your own privilege in the system and not. But knowing, remembering that it's different for all of us. So Resma Meenakkam is this phenomenal activist, writer, practitioner, and he talks about the idea that we need to create a new culture of whiteness without supremacy. So yes, it is up to all mothers everywhere to create that inclusive, healing, like loving culture that we want our children to inherit. But it is primarily the work of white, straight, cisgender women mothers to shoulder the majority of the burden. So in order to do that, we have to work to create, we have to change the culture. This is the revolution. We have to create a new culture that is actively anti-racist, and it associates being white with being anti-racist. We're redefining the word to mean, and so when ideally, like when our children or our children's children start to talk about whiteness, it means to them an ideology that is actively anti-racist and it is actively against white body supremacy. That's big work, but we can do it, right? So what would it mean to create a culture of whiteness without supremacy? Finding leaders who are already doing the work, white leaders who are leading the way in creating this culture, like the Peggy McIntosh, Robin DiAngelo, and more. You know, we can listen and we can learn and we can create a deliberate culture and community around being anti-racist. That can be the thing that brings us all together. And we're perfectly capable of doing this work, right? When my instinct is to be like, I don't know what to do, someone tell me, that just feeds into the white fragility. No, we got this. I promise we can do this. So how do we do better, right? What, and again, rhetorical, think in the back of your head, what actions do white-bodied mothers need to take to dismantle the system of whiteness and white body supremacy? What do we need to teach our children about whiteness? What do we need to talk about publicly? What do we need to learn ourselves? These are the questions we start to ask. All right, capitalism. So capitalism is, it's not just about, you know, private people owning businesses. It is a system based on the private ownership of the means of production. So like they own the things that makes the things. And it's based around competition and the accumulation of surplus value. When you're in competition with everyone else to increase profits and to increase your market share, keeps labor costs low. And there's this like expectation that you can just extract natural resources at the lowest possible cost, right? We can look out to the world and say, oh, look, there's water that has been freely provided. I'm going to bottle it and sell it and make a profit because I can. Yay. Under this system, if you are the most environmentally conscious and like social conscious owner possible, you still have to engage in practices that are destructive to labor and the environment. The system can't win, right? And then again, over time, that capital accumulates to fewer and fewer hands. This is where we get the 1% and the 0.1%. I think I saw something that eight people own the same amount of wealth as 39% of the world. What? It's like a movie. It's like a bad movie. So those who have those resources, they use it to fix the system and continue to benefit themselves. So we end up with this billionaire class that has too much influence over our democracy, and they're building spaceships and they're doing things on their own agenda. And I don't know that I want them responsible for building the world that my children are going to inherit. It's not a sustainable system. Now, I'm going to be fair. It's not all bad. Capitalism did create, through competition, a lot of medical technology, scientific knowledge, right? We have made progress because of capitalism. Karl Marx himself even believed that capitalism was a necessary step in our sort of economic evolution. He just didn't think it needed to end there. And there's debate about that, but it's not all bad. That's my fair statement. Okay, so mothering under capitalism, what does it mean to be a mother in a capitalist system? Well, unless you are an owner or part of the billionaire class, in which case, hi, let's talk. You're a worker, right? And we have to hire ourselves out in the market to earn a wage. But that when it comes to trying to have a career as a mother, we run into very specific challenges, starting with the fact that, right, there's no maternity leave. Yes, many mothers are allowed to take some time off from their jobs without being fired, but that's up to the private corporations. So let's just assume you're back to work at 3 months old, right? You've got a baby, 3 months later, you've somehow managed to get back to work. Well, now you got to put your baby in daycare. And the cost of daycare for a newborn, it's about $10,000 a year. So this puts many families in the position of deciding, is it financially worth it for someone to work full-time and pay for childcare? Or is it better to have one person leave their job? And because of the gender wage gap, patriarchy, men make more money. So typically in that average nuclear family arrangement, the mother is going to be the one who has to leave her career. And then the success, this reinforces men being head of the household, that patriarchal family dynamic. And then, of course, mothers leaving their career has long-lasting ramifications, right? They're not saving for retirement, contributing to Social Security. Their career options are limited when you return. I was born in 1981. My mom worked. I was like, you can have it all, right? The shoulder pads, and you can do all the things. And there's going to be a woman for president someday, and you can have it all. And then Sheryl Sandberg and that sort of lean in mentality of the early 2000s, that was like my coming of age. I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to demand a seat at the table. And all that really did, like, mothers just got totally left out of the picture. It really just reinforced and propped up this kind of capitalist credo of working, right? So there's a lot here, but the pandemic was a wake-up call when we had 2 million women left the workforce to care for children or elders. So there's a lot out there now talking, I'm not the only person talking about this, which is helpful. So within patriarchal motherhood under capitalism, a woman is considered to be below her husband in the hierarchy, right? And up until recently, she and her children were little more than property. Adrienne Rich points out in A Woman Born, she says, historically, to bear a child out of wedlock has been to violate the property laws that say a woman and her child must legally belong to some man. So again, this is that challenging that narrative of that nuclear family. If you do not belong to that narrative of nuclear family, you have to prove your worth. You are not already seen as inherently worthy. You've got these additional steps you have to take. Without a government-assisted social system. So yes, we have welfare. But if you've ever tried to apply for welfare in this country, there's a lot of steps you have to take. There's a lot of hurdles. And this quote, society needs women on welfare as examples to let every woman, factory worker, and housewife worker know what will happen if she tries to do it alone without a man. You know, the Reagan administration, they're vitriolic, horrifying, you know, the welfare queen taking advantage of the system. I have a friend in Denmark, and she and I talk all the time about this. And, you know, she talks about the welfare state because Denmark just like pays for this. And the welfare state to her is great. It's just part of their system. So we've been trained to believe that the only reason people are on welfare is because there's something wrong with her character. But it's another way to control women and to control our bodies and to control motherhood. Okay, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. This one's important. I'm sure you guys are familiar with this. If you're not, it's a theory of human development that says like the universal needs of society are at the base. And then when each condition is fulfilled, you can like the person is motivated and able to arise to the next stage. And here's the thing. Under capitalism, nearly every single one of our basic physiological needs of survival cost money. Food, water, shelter, clothing, healthcare, none of it. None of it is free. None of it is guaranteed to us. We've let everything be put out to the market for a price. Again, now we're starting to see all these systems of interrelationness. We've got patriarchal motherhood. We've got whiteness. We've got capitalism. Under all these systems, it's kind of burying us. It's women, and it's especially women of color who are experiencing these unacceptable levels of housing and food insecurity. And for me, I think we need to start by reframing what it means to have a basic human right. Like, what is a human right? We've been so concerned with like the right to free speech and the right to vote and the right to bear arms and the right to practice religion. And don't get me wrong, these are important rights. Don't take them away from us. But like, what about the right to clean water? The right to safe and secure housing? The right to healthy, nutritious food? Right, the rights to our very own bodies. So I think redefining what we consider to be important human rights is a critical step to the revolution. So the questions, how do our actions align with our values? But like when it comes to advocating for public policy and for all mothers, how do we ensure that we are acting within our values? Doing okay. All right. Last one. Religion. Ah. I studied a lot about my master's is in women, gender, spirituality, and social justice. So I wrote a paper about cultural motherhood norms defined by religious narratives. And I just kind of explored the different cultural expectations of motherhood in different religions. So like, how did creation stories affect it? Religious narratives of fertility and childbirth, and then religious stories of motherhood. And I'm not going to go into all of these in detail, but you know, you think of the biblical creation story, you know, Adam and Eve, and Eve submits to Adam, and then she sins. And like, now, you know, everything that women have to do is like retribution for Eve's sins. So this really reinforces that experience of patriarchal motherhood, right? Men feel justified by God himself in replicating the domination, where it goes God, man, woman, child, animal, plant, rock. So it creates innumerable challenges for anybody who's not seen to be like living out God's perfect family. But you contrast this with some of the Native American creation stories. Sky Woman is an example, and the details vary by region and by tribe. But in one version, a woman falls from the sky, and with her, she brings seeds, dirt, and her daughter. And wherever she stepped, she created the earth. So in this story, not only was the creator of the world a woman, she was a mother. Ah! So the legend continues to go on. It credits her daughter as the provider of tobacco and strawberries. Sky Woman goes on to have twin boys who represent the need for balance in all aspects of life. So this is a mother-centered creation story that features a mother-daughter relationship and also a partnership with animals and all that. Like, with this creation story at the heart of society, just imagine what that would do. And many Native American tribes were organized very differently than European households. Women were experiencing more economic independence, community support, and respect in policy. So this is just a quote from Robin Wall Kimmerer about one story leads to, you know, generous embrace and one leads to banishment. You can see the dichotomy here. So again, narratives around childbirth and fertility. There's a whole thing about fertility in the Bible. You know, Sarah, Rachel, Leah, they all have to ask God to grant them children, which kind of reinforces that a woman is only worthy if she has a child. And then this idea that childbirth is painful. And so in retribution for Eve's sins, we have to have pain for motherhood. Like, of course, we have been internalizing this message for centuries. It's hard to see outside of that. But I know several of you I know are working in the birth world. And I know you're like, ah, it's poking at you. I get it. And I want to make this note that I feel like is really kind of clever. It feels like appropriating the natural physical symptoms of labor as God's punishment. It's kind of a convenient way to have every woman who has a baby be forced to identify with the ease of sin. Like, oh, did that hurt? Well, you are sinful. That's basically why. Oh, that's convenient. No, thank you. So we're going to contrast this with the Yoruba goddess, Oshun. She's associated with fertility. She's a very powerful goddess, and this has a really positive effect on a lot of pregnant women. Let's keep going. Mary. So now getting into the narratives of what it does it mean to be a mother themselves, right? So much of our understanding is defined by Mary. She's the mother of Jesus. She's the ultimate role model for the Christian woman. And her characteristics, compassion, piety, humbleness. The angel Gabriel comes and says, you're going to give birth to God's son. She's like, I'm the Lord's servant. Bring it on. She never displays jealousy, sexual desire, greed, and she never displays anger. Mary had to birth her child in, you know, the middle of winter in a barn full of animals, and no one felt any rage. Like, there was no anger at all. Then she was set aside by her son as he began his teachings. And she kind of, her only son is like tortured and killed in front of her. And instead of showing rage and fury and tearing down the Roman Empire, she just is sad. So this image of Mary as the perfect woman to be mother obviously has impacted us in what we think a mother should be. We can contrast this with Kali. The Hindu goddess Kali, she delights in feeling all the emotions. Right? She can be understood as a bloodthirsty warrior, a goddess of ritual possession, a tantric sexual partner, and an all-loving, compassionate mother. She's all of them. And she's really been an inspiration for feminists who have been searching for a strong female divine presence, because she kind of creates it all. And you can call on different aspects of Kali for support in times of need, whether you need to call on her fury and her rage, or you need to call on her benevolence. And there's no need to feel shame or guilt about anger when that emotion is validated by a goddess. So patriarchal motherhood under this religious narrative, like it's justified by the divine right of God, also creates this idea that women are objects and they really are only seen in relation to the people that they serve. So this is where we get into the media, right? Here are some of our good mothers. You've got Mary, you know, you've got Maria, Von Trapp. So we see how our culture has been shaped to what means to be a good mother. So some, you've got nurturing and selfless and a protector, a literal superhero, right? Gentle and kind. And then the bad mothers. Now, to be fair, Medea did kill her children. I'm not condoning that. But like these mothers are totally reviled and they're shown with almost no redeeming qualities. They're neglectful, they're selfish, they're sexual, they're obsessed with money, they're criminals. So like, this is how these narratives continue to shape us and our experiences. So this is one of my key messages and one of my big kind of motivating factors. Like, what if motherhood itself was actually a spiritual path? Can we reject a religious narrative that says that we aren't spiritual or that says anything other than this? Like, even if you don't consider yourself to be religious, it's important to understand that if you live in the United States, the dominant religious narratives have almost certainly shaped your understanding of motherhood in some way. But if you think about it, like being a mother, the amount of patience and focus that it takes for me to be present with my children, it's greater than anything I've ever experienced in over 20 years of my yoga practice, right? Like, you can forget about renouncing all your possessions and going to live on the side of a mountaintop. Like, that's way too easy. In solitude, yeah, sign me up. That's like a retreat. But if we can reframe the challenges of motherhood and dive in, the only way out is through, right? It's like an express ticket to spiritual evolution. So when we consider the systems of religion and how they shape our lives, we can, again, stop to challenge the narrative that no longer works for us. And I want to acknowledge real quickly our own privilege of being able to gather as a group of women, even virtually. Like, this privilege is denied to so many women around the world. You know, I was able to host a call and we can sit here and talk about defying God and defying the natural order of things. And I'm not worried that someone's going to put me in jail or shoot me or any of that. So like, just acknowledging that privilege and that reality, we're not out of the woods yet because this is still denied to so many. But yeah, that's it. Thank you so much. I'm going to go ahead and end it out. And I hope you guys have a great afternoon.
Stay tuned for more empowering stories and insightful discussions in future episodes of Rebel Mothers. Remember to subscribe, rate, and share this podcast to spread the message far and wide. Learn more at susiefishleader.com. And thank you for being part of the motherhood revolution.